Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me, as always, is my friend, colleague, Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
And we're also joined by our special friend, Ryan Henson, Policy Director at the California Wilderness Coalition. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
All right. So today we're going to be talking about the August complex, the fire that occurred, the fire suppression activities that went on and their potential impact on the environment, as well as plans for moving forward. How are we going to manage this fire affected landscape? So, Larry, you are intimately familiar with the August complex. Tell us what happened with that fire.
Yeah, we had a middle of summer thunderstorm event that came on shore just north of the Bay Area and then proceeded in a sort of north-northeasterly direction, went through Sonoma into Mendocino County, went through the interior of Mendocino County, and then into southeastern Trinity County, all the while just discharging lightning like crazy. That went on for a couple of days. Different spots got hammered harder on the different days, but all told about 3 days of intense lightning in different locations, which of course then sparked hundreds of fires because it was already a very hot and dry summer anyway. And then shortly after that, it got even hotter and even drier. So the fires meandered around for quite a while. They were some of them running up against the old burn scars in Mendocino of the ranch fire. Yeah, the ranch fire. They were bumping into the burn areas there. So it was not burning up a lot of houses right initially. But as it continued on, it started threatening over on the east side of Mendocino County, over Pascenta is the name of the area that it started really taking off in that area. Then it was meandering around in the Yolaboli Wilderness area and actually probably being beneficial for quite, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks of the fire. It was kind of a beneficial wildfire, just burning the old boys, no wind-driven events. But then everything changed in late August, and the wind came up, and we started having wind events. The very first big wind event blew the fire out of the Yolaboli Wilderness areas and into a little community in southern Six Rivers National Forest called Three Forks, and just ripped right through that community, burned almost all of the houses in that community. From there, we had several more wind events that happened about once a week. We were having these big northeasterly gusty wind events. The final wind event that really, really wreaked havoc was the one later in September, and it was when the fire had been being sort of managed on Rattlesnake Ridge, which is just east of Forest Glen, the community of Forest Glen, and they've been trying to save Trinity Pines. There's a lot of people living back in Trinity Pond. There's like 550 parcels or something back in there. So they were really concerned about all the little grow operations and people living back in there. So they really tried to hold the line with Rattlesnake Ridge. And most of the time, the wind had been coming from the south, so their firing operations along Rattlesnake were working pretty well. All of a sudden, the wind switched to the east, and the backfiring operations that they had been doing got away from them, and then we had this 20,000-foot-tall pyrocumulus cloud form from the fire, and it just darkened the sky, and then when those clouds eventually collapsed, usually, and that's what happened, and the wind was blowing from the east, so it sent all the shards and embers and whatnot to the west, as far west as Hettenshaw Valley, so it covered all of Ruth Lake, into Hettenshaw Valley, into Trinity County, into the edges of western Humboldt County. And that's when the majority of houses were lost in the northern part of the August complex.
So this is the first gigafire that we've had in a while, at least I think in recorded history. So in about the past 150 years in California. So a gigafire being over 1 million acres burned in total. And this fits a lot of the patterns that we know of for California fires when they get big. These are primarily weather-driven events where you have extremely low forest moisture, and you also couple that with high wind events that really blow and push these fires to grow and just jump rapidly. I remember this fire, and I think I will always remember this fire, because I was out hiking in the middle of nowhere and didn't have cell phone reception, and I get off of the trail and get back into town and turn my phone on, and it just starts to melt with all of the text messages that I got from folks on the East Coast wondering if I was okay, because they had heard that there was a fire burning in Humboldt County. So I will never forget getting off the trail and just wondering what the heck could be happening back home, and just being so concerned, you know, that something like paradise happened somewhere in Humboldt County, and being so thankful that, you know, for the most part, we avoided a very severe tragedy with this fire.
Yeah, there was a moment there where it looked like Southern Humboldt was at risk. They had started evacuating all along the 101 corridor in Southern Humboldt. So that certainly made the national news.
So, Larry, I also wanted to touch on a point that you raised in your description of the fire, which is how a lot of properties actually burn. So I think that most people assume that when a fire consumes a house, it's because of something like a fire taking over the house like a wave. You know, you see the fire coming down the hill slope and then it sweeps over your house and keeps going. A lot of houses in California burn because of these embers. The embers will get into the attic area. They'll blow in through an unscreened vent, or they will land in your gutters that are full of dry pine needles. And that's what will catch the fire. So you can often be miles away from the fire, the front line of the fire, and your house could still burn. So this is a friendly reminder that now that we are in the wet season, go out there, clean out your gutters, start to work on fireproofing your house, hardening your house. Every little thing can add up and can help. It can be an expensive venture. You know, you can replace all your siding with hardy board and really make it a bomb-proof structure. There's also things that you can do for a lot less money. You can get a home roof sprinkler system for, I think, about $200 now. So any investment in your house to make it more fire resilient, especially if you live in a fire-prone community, is probably a good investment if you can afford it.
One of the things I want to mention real quick that we learned, all of us out that were the victims of the Hawkins complex, was that life as you know it in an emergency like that just ceases. So cell phone service, you might regularly have it, it failed in the middle of this disaster because there were too many people using the cell tower. Electricity was out because the poles were burning up and the lines were down. The landline phone service was out. So communication and power and fuel. There was no way to get more gasoline. Because they shut down the local stores that were nearby that were the only places you could get gasoline. So people that were relying on their generators when the power went out were running out of fuel. The thing is that you have to really plan for the worst. You can't sort of halfway plan. And like Tom said, there were people that I know that had defensible space cleared around their places and still had their houses burned down because they just got buried in embers.
So Ryan, and in particular, let's talk about the Yolo Boli Wilderness. So Larry mentioned that the fire had potential beneficial effects. And this is something that I think is criminally underreported, which is that fire is not all bad, right? Fire is bad when it kills someone, if it takes a structure that we're trying to defend. But fire is a natural component to our forest landscapes here in California. We could be outside of some sort of range of natural variability, and that's a topic for discussion and for investigation. But fire is an ecosystem process, and it's a vital, vital ecosystem process for some types of ecosystems. So can you talk about how the fire played, what it did in the Yolo Bolis, and how it had beneficial effects for that ecosystem?
Sure. We flew over what became the August complex in the Yolo Bolis a week before the fire, flew it with an outfit called EcoFlight, and shot film the whole way. And then a couple weeks after August complex, we took the same route and filmed the forest again this time. For the most part, the forest, particularly the old growth forest in the Yolo Boli Middle Eel Wilderness, did very well with the fire. And people should remember, as you said, Tom, fire is a natural process. Our plant communities in California, the vast majority of the land-based plant communities, the terrestrial plant communities, have evolved with fire. And indeed, they need fire to stay healthy and to, you know, sustain the ecosystem. And that is absolutely true of old growth, what's called mixed conifer forest, or forest of multiple different kinds of conifer species, the kinds we have in here in Northwest California, like the sugar pine and the ponderosa and the Jeffrey and the Doug fir and the many other species, the inset cedar. They all can benefit from fire. And the bigger a tree is, the older a tree is, the more fire resilient, the more fire resistant it is. And that's why when we convert our forests to young forests, young trees, just thickets of young trees, they're far more likely to be destroyed by fire. So yes, a natural uncut forest has evolved with fire in California. The only even remote exception is, I guess, the wettest stands of Coast Redwood experience fire on a much longer scale, maybe than the interior forests, that's for sure. But the interior forests, such as what we're talking about here today, definitely need fire to remain healthy. And what was very disturbing in the August complex is the greatest damage done to the Olibolis by fire suppression. I just received today photographs from a friend of mine, Susan Nolan, that you know, Tom, who visited the Olibolis and took a lot of pictures of the fire suppression. And it's very disturbing. Tons of trees, including old growth trees, were downed for, I guess, purposes of creating fire breaks. But I really have to wonder maybe I'm just of the opinion that drastic action like that should only be taken when human life is at stake. Otherwise, it just seemed very heavy-handed.
For California that invests so much money into doing prescribed fire, when fire naturally occurs on our landscape and then we work so hard to put it out, it seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Sure does. Especially, may I add too, the Olibolis are a place where the Forest Service is actually allowed to use fire as a management tool. They actually have that authority, and yet they chose not to do that in the August complex because it was a big, scary fire. And I understand that. The idea of the liability about fire is tremendous, and heavy is the head that wears the crown. I would not want to be a forest supervisor and have to worry about a fire escaping and destroying a community. However, it is destroying the ecosystem. So we got to do something about it.
So what Ryan was talking about, I have seen as well as I've been going through areas that were touched by the August complex. There seemed to be an attack on trees, standing trees, if they were going to potentially become a hazard at some point in the firefighting effort, they just dropped them. And it's all along the top of South Fork Mountain. There's just trees laying on the ground all over the place. And what's weird to me is that the fire basically was not being carried by in the trees. It was on the ground. It was the dry fuels on the forest floor that were carrying the fire. So dropping trees seemed like they were just feeding the fire and not to drop a big tree on the ground. So it's counterintuitive to see so many trees drop down.
If I'm going to be a little bit conspiratorial, I would point out that the Forest Service is now offering a lot of those trees that they dropped for fire prevention or fire suppression in timber sales. So they've stacked them all on log decks, and now they're selling a lot of the trees that were downed. So perhaps there is some sort of financial incentive, although that as I said, that is conspiratorial. So I do think, though, and Larry, this is something I've heard you express before, that the way we go about fire suppression often doesn't feel like it is properly influenced by local expertise. Can you tell us about, can you give us your critique on how fire crews are being run through our national forest?
And I want to be clear, I'm not criticizing the fire crews. I love the fire crews. They saved my house. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the upper management. So what happens when you have a big enough forest fire, it becomes a national incident, and they bring in these national incident teams to fight the fire. And so once the national incident team is on the ground, the locals kind of get kicked to the curb. I mean, they might still talk to them, but technically they don't need to if they don't want to. and they just take over the fire, and they rotate them out about every 10 days or so. A new incident team comes in and takes over. That's what we experienced during the August fire. As soon as you start to get to know the team that was there, they were gone. And this new team was there, and they would take over. And with the August complex, they had it divided between the north and south. In fact, at one point, they had it divided into four different areas where they had different incident teams managing the four areas. And they were sort of communicating with each other, but they weren't talking to the locals. The big difference with this fire was when the Alaska team came in, the Alaska incident team, they really wanted to talk to the people on the ground. And I got fortunately, thanks to Kristen Lark, who's the district ranger in Mad River, hooked me up with the Alaska team. I got to talk to them. One of the reasons that my property didn't get burnt any worse than it did was that when I explained to them the logical control point, one of them was Hidden Valley Road, which I live on, and there was a number of other geologic features that I pointed out to them that were good control features for them to use to stop the fire. They actually listened to me. But none of the other teams that were there really reached out for any local input on the conditions on the ground and the terrain and things like that. And like I said, these people are from Colorado and other places. They weren't from California. They really didn't know what was going on. And they'd be there for 10 days. And about the time they were starting to get it figured out, they were gone. It's a very strange way to go about it. It seems like a military approach when what we need is to have, I think, at all times, some sort of local cadre that's there that is always being consulted by the national team. If we're going to be using these national teams, there needs to be a local team that has to sort of clear what the national team does. Then I think they might not be so reckless with some of the things they do, like the burnouts that they do. You know, when you got to live in a place and then you decide to light a whole hillside on fire to stop the fire, you're going to maybe think twice about the resources you're sacrificing to stop the fire if you live there. And you're going to be at some point held accountable by your peers and your neighbors for your decisions.
The Eco News Report. I'm talking with Ryan Henson of the California Wilderness Coalition about the August complex fires and the proposed post-fire response by the Forest Service. So I want to kind of recap our conversation so far. So we've talked about how fire is a natural component of California's forested ecosystems and beyond just California's ecosystems. You know, in the Yolobolis, we have meadow areas which are maintained by fire. Otherwise, we'd have conifer encroachment into those meadows. So fire has to occur or else we will snuff out those ecosystems. So fire is natural. It often performs good work on our lands. It does the fuels reduction work for us. It is a bad thing when it potentially harms human life or structures. And then we have stacked on top of that impacts from fire suppression. And so these include things like running bulldozer lines, so where they just scrape the ground trying to get it down to mineral soil to create a fire line, a hard break, so that fires won't continue past a certain area. You have new road construction. You have felling of trees that could be a hazard to the fire crews. You have all sorts of stuff, the dropping of fire retardant. All of this adds up and is an impact on the environment in addition to that caused by the fire. So we have two disturbances. And now, transitioning, we have a potential third disturbance on our ecosystems, and that is our post-fire management priorities. So, Ryan, I know that you have been carefully monitoring what the forests in our area, the Six Rivers National Forest, Shasta Trinity National Forest, and Mendocino National Forest, what they are thinking about doing after these fires. Can you give a brief summation of what sort of post-fire management they are proposing?
Well, the only documents we've seen so far from the agencies from the three national forests that you mentioned is a collective assessment of post-fire, what they call recovery opportunities. Disturbingly, the document talked about soil, water, timber, and maybe a couple other issues, but it did not discuss recreation, including trails and roads and other things that people use all the time in the forest. And it basically focused primarily on post-fire logging opportunities, which was pretty disturbing, or what's called salvage logging, a term that a lot of us don't like to use because it's misleading. But post-fire logging is some of the most destructive kinds of logging that exist on public land. It's sort of like beating up a burn victim. And the document was filled with speculation as to how much timber could be extracted, burned timber could be extracted from the August Complex footprint, while at the same time admitting that, for the most part, the fire had either minor to moderate impacts, for the most part. And so, as is typical of very large weather-driven fires that in a fire-adapted landscape. And so it didn't actually bother to do what the Forest Service sometimes does, which is to actually argue that the logging is somehow necessary for the recovery of the forest. It just assumed that the logging was good and necessary and didn't bother to justify it. But those of us who were fans of these forests were pretty troubled by this. One, they should have talked about other things like roads, trails, and other needs out there on the landscape. Those are actually the longer term things to be concerned about. And issues like, what are they going to do with all these fire lines they put in? They put in a gigantic fire line in the Yuki Wilderness, which has no trails, but they punched in a giant fire line through it. And how do we know it's not being used by vehicles now? Have they sufficiently blocked it to vehicles? How do we know it's not going to erode into the steelhead-bearing streams that they punched the fire line through? The document didn't discuss any of those issues. So, yeah, that's all we've seen from the Forest Service, and it's inadequate and disturbing, and we're hoping for better, a more holistic approach to post-fire work.
And we've seen the cartels love those fire lines, Ryan, because they have those side-by-sides now, and the side-by-sides just roll right over the water bars, right down the dozer line.
Larry, what is a side-by-side?
Side-by-side is a four-wheeled, it's not a motorcycle anymore, it's big. It's like a miniature Jeep, kind of, but it's got smaller wheels, and they're called side-by-sides.
They look like a golf cart.
Yeah, they can accommodate like four passengers, some of them. Actually, I've seen when the cartels are using, they cram eight people in these things, but they can cover some rough terrain, and all it needs to have is be open like that, like a dozer line. And even if they put big, steep water bars in it, the side-by-sides can go right over those. It doesn't seem to slow them down. So that's a problem with those dozer lines in the wilderness in particular, but anywhere in the forest.
So, Larry, if you were to devise some sort of a post-fire strategy for our national forests, what would you want them to do? Imagine a forest supervisor is coming to you and asking for your advice. How should they respond to these fires?
Well, the number one thing I would do is when the incident is considered to be contained and they're happy with it, and it's not out necessarily, but it's not spreading anymore, they just leave and all the resources go with them. I'd say that should stop right away, and they should still be keeping the crews and the resources there to repair some of what's had to be done during the fire. Like when they use heavy equipment on roads, the roads need to be fixed after all that heavy equipment's been riding on the roads. The culverts get plugged up, they need to get unplugged. Ditches get filled up, they need to be, you know, opened back up again. Because then when it rains, if those things aren't fixed, then you have road failures and all that sediment winds up in whatever watershed. That's one thing. The dozer lines need to be really worked on. In some years, I see them where they've had to drop trees for whatever hazard reasons, take those trees and lay them across the dozer lines along with the water bar. But they lay the trees sort of horizontally across the dozer line. It's amazing how much sediment those trees catch when they're laying on the dozer line. There's a bunch of sheet erosion that takes place and the trees catch that. Not to mention it makes them impassable then, even for those side-by-sides when you get a big tree laying across. I think that should all be still part of the fire suppression activities at the end of the fire That stuff needs to be taken care of. Then if afterwards, then there's resources that can be captured, like trees that had to be laid down. I can understand dragging those to a landing and making them available for the public to cut firewood or possibly selling them for timber, but for lumber. But I've questioned the value of salvage sales. I understand the hazard tree removal around the roadways and around the campgrounds. And I would, like Ryan says, I would add trails to that because a lot of our trails don't get paid attention to, and those hazard trees fall right across the trail. And the next time you try and hike on it, you're busy having to climb over these big trees all the time. Doesn't make for a fun hike then.
No. And unfortunately, because the feds fail to clean up their mess after they make it, this is often used as a justification for that post-fire logging, that we need to bring in a bunch of money so that we can go do things like fix the culverts that we screwed up or repair the roads.
You don't do that. That's I've witnessed now half a dozen salvage sales after fires. And they go in and they say, oh, yeah, we've got to go in here and harvest to reduce the fuel. Instead, what they take the big stems out and they leave all the little stems on the ground. And so you have the recipe for the next fire, which, you know, there was a salvage sale on South Fork Mountain about 5 years ago. Fire came up this year, burned through all that salvage sale and burned hot because they left so much fuel on the ground. So they just took out the big sticks and left all the little stuff behind.
Well, Ryan, I think that Larry just beat me to my next question, which was going to be how does post-fire logging, how can it actually worsen fuel conditions and increase the risk of a fire coming back and burning in that same area and burning pretty hot?
You know, years ago, the University of California, Davis, my alma mater, they had something called the Sierra Nevada Ecosystem Project Report that definitively stated that logging has increased fire severity in the Sierra Nevada, at least, more than any other human activity. And you might ask, well, how can that be? Especially when politicians and others are arguing that logging is actually somehow good for fire. Well, the reason is that big fuel in the form of a big old tree is turned into little more flammable fuel in the form of branches, bark, and the other material left over after logging on the forest floor. That material is called slash. It's the material that's not hauled in the log truck to the mill. All that stuff gets left behind in the woods. Sometimes it gets piled up into piles and then burned later. That's actually a better thing. But often it's just left scattered across the forest floor. And then when you have small trees and brush growing up among all that slash, it just creates a really fine mix of fuel that can lead to greater fires in the future. In addition, the Forest Service has a terrible habit, a long tradition of planting little trees in rows after fires. And little trees growing in rows with interlocking crowns don't do very well with fire, disease, or any other natural process. It's the hatchery fish of trees. It just doesn't do very well. And it's time that we move away from this habit of replanting. You know, it's hard to stop the forest in many places from regrowing. I don't think we really need to plant trees in rows and then spend decades worrying about those trees burning down. I think nature can do its own recovery. We just need to make room for it. And it starts with leaving those big trees standing.
And I will just point out that leaving those big trees standing it's going to improve the habitat function, the habitat value for that regrowing forest. So if you're an owl, you can perch on the branch of a standing dead tree, a snag, and look for your wood rats scurrying along in that regrowing forest. You can't do that if you're an owl, if there are no more large standing dead trees. So we are stunting the forest ecologically by cutting it after a fire.
And those big trees create shade, Tom, and the little trees grow in the shade of the big trees.
Yeah, it's too hot, and especially it's getting hotter out there, as we all know. So it's important that we retain forest moisture and shade as much as we can. So, Larry, I want to touch on some logging that is currently ongoing. So the Forest Service hasn't begun to log yet, but other people are logging. Other public agencies are logging in our area. I was traveling on 36 the other day and saw a lot of action. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, it's difficult to even get through because they have the highway closed for most of the day. They only let you through at five different openings during the daytime. From the top of South Fork Mountain, about 8 miles east to just past Forest Glen, they have been basically clear cutting along the side of Highway 36, about 250 feet from the side of the road in some areas. And they're taking everything. They're not leaving anything. It's just bare ground, well, slash. That's what Ryan is describing. But all living things seem to be being cut down and hauled away. And I'm even hearing loggers complaining about it. They're like, why are they taking every single tree? A lot of these trees weren't even touched by the fire. But Caltrans apparently has some sort of long-standing agreement with the Forest Service, and they've enacted it, declaring it an emergency threat to human life and safety. And so under that, they haven't had to do any kind of environmental documentation of what they're doing. And they've been logging it now for months.
So, I mean, this makes sense. As much as I always complain about the Forest Service, I think I complain more about Caltrans. Ryan, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I was going to ask if they're taking out the oaks, but it sounds like they're taking everything, Larry said. So that's a shame.
That's the reports I've got, is that everything's going. When I drove through there a month or so ago, that is what it looked like to me. They were taking everything. Madrones, oaks, you name it.
Well, so this was the first gigafire in modern history in California. Given climate change and given that fire conditions are likely going to worsen, it's probably not going to be our last. So it's important that we learn from the August complex, learn about how fire affects the landscape, learn about how we can reduce impacts when trying to manage fire as it is currently burning, and how we can reduce impacts after the fire has burned. So I'd like to really thank my guests, Ryan Henson from the California Wilderness Coalition.
Thank you.
And as always, Larry Glass, my co-host and friend from the North Coast Environmental Center.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you both for joining the show. All right. Have a good one, fellas. And join us next week on This Time and Channel for more Eco News Report.